Alicia let him move back in. He spent much of the fall at home with John Charles, watching science fiction programs on television, like Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. He was writing a great many letters and making many phone calls to mathematicians in Princeton and elsewhere. He was still obsessed with the idea of asylum. A letter to Martha and Charlie, postmarked November 19th, reads, "Maybe you will say that I'm mad. Request to St. Paul's in Princeton for sanctuary." Nash apparently walked past St. Paul's every day. The letter referred to the Ecumenical Council and previous letters he had written to the pastor of St. Paul's earlier in the month. The letter ended with a reference to past misfortunes, especially in the fall season. In contrast to his letter to Martha from London, Nash no longer interpreted his difficulties as a sign of illness, but rather as the results of machinations by the Ecumenical Council. By January, his letters to Martha and Charlie had become nearly incomprehensible. The thoughts skipping from Albanians to Stalin to secrets can't reveal and wooden nails of the true cross. Exhausted and dispirited by 3 years of turmoil and convinced that Nash's condition was more or less hopeless, Alicia consulted an attorney and instituted divorce proceedings. She had married someone who she thought could look after her, but couldn't, who resented her bitterly, and who accused her of having malevolent intentions. To Martha and Virginia, she wrote that being married was helping to create Nash's problems, and that she felt that being freed from the marriage would be better for him as well. Alicia's attorney, Frank F. Scott, a genial Princeton divorce lawyer with an office on Nassau Street, filed for a divorce the day after Christmas, 1962. Alicia had given the formal go-ahead in a deposition a week earlier. According to the petition, Nash was still living with her at 137 Spruce Street. Alicia, meanwhile, temporarily rented a separate apartment on Vandeventer Street. Alicia's formal complaint read, "On or about March 1959, it was necessary for the plaintiff herein to cause the defendant to be committed to a mental institution, from which the defendant was released on or about June 1959. Despite the fact that said committal was in the best interest of the defendant became very resentful of the plaintiff for causing his commitment, and declared he would no longer live with the plaintiff as man and wife. Consistent with the defendant's vow not to again live with the plaintiff as her husband, the defendant did in fact move into a separate room and refused to have marital relations with the plaintiff. In January 1961, defendant was caused to be committed to Trenton State Hospital by his mother, from which he was released in June 1961. The defendant's resentment of his wife and insistence that they no longer have marital relations continued after his release from the aforementioned commitment, as it had prior to said commitment, and has continued against the wishes of the plaintiff to the present date. The time during which defendant has thus deserted plaintiff, and during which defendant was not confined to any institution, but fully able to voluntarily resume marital relations, which he has not done, exceeds 2 years past, and such desertion has been willful, continuous, and obstinate. Moreover, defendant has failed to properly support plaintiff." Nash was served with a summons. Scott visited Nash the following day. On April 17th, Scott once again talked to Nash, who he said had no plans for changing either his residence or his occupational status. The judgment was rendered without a trial, granting a divorce, and awarding Alicia custody of John Charles on May 1, 1963. Final judgment was rendered August 2, 1963. There is no evidence that Nash was opposed to the divorce. While the petition was a lawyer's document and not necessarily true in its particulars, the Danskins, for example, maintained that Nash and Alicia never stopped sleeping together. Nash's animosity toward Alicia was no doubt very real. He blamed Alicia for engineering his hospitalizations. He had threatened to divorce her while at McLean, and probably afterward as well, and he had made plans to live in France without her. Nash's increasingly disturbed state and rumors of his impending divorce prompted a number of mathematicians to rally around him that spring. That Nash desperately needed treatment was not a subject of controversy this time. Once again, Donald Spencer and Albert Tucker approached Robert Winters. James Miller, a friend of Winters from Harvard, was in the psychiatry department at the University of Michigan and was connected with a university-sponsored clinic run by Ray Wagoner. Through Miller, Winters succeeded in making a unique arrangement whereby Nash would be treated at the clinic and also have an opportunity to work as a statistician in the clinic's research program. Tucker at Princeton and Martin at MIT decided to set up a fund to make the Michigan plan feasible. Anatole Rapoport and Merrill Flood at the University of Michigan, Jürgen Moser at NYU, Alexander Ostrowski at Westinghouse, and others committed themselves to raise funds among mathematicians on Nash's behalf. The Ann Arbor group felt that a stay of 2 years was necessary. The cost for out-of-state patients was $9,000 a year or $18,000 for the entire stay. Virginia Nash offered to guarantee $10,000, and the group of mathematicians arranged through the American Mathematical Society to set up a fundraising drive for the remaining $8,000. "If we're successful, probably most of it will have to come from mathematicians who have known Nash," Martin wrote. "If anything can be done which will enable Nash to return to mathematics, even on a very limited scale, it would of course be very fine not only for him, but also for mathematics." Albert E. Meader, Jr., the Society's treasurer, was enthusiastic about the proposal, saying that, "It would seem to me that it would be altogether appropriate for the AMS to receive contributions for the purposes set forth in Martin's letter of March 25th. I would be inclined to go ahead." Nash's increasingly bizarre behavior was triggering complaints, including some at the Institute for Advanced Study. Mostly, these had to do with Nash's writing mysterious messages on the Institute blackboards and making annoying telephone calls to various members. But one day, the switchboard operators, who sat in an office immediately as one entered Fold Hall, were all abuzz because each person who was coming through the door was being doused with water. The Institute's dining hall was then on the fourth floor of Fold, and it turned out, upon investigation, that Nash had been pouring water from the window above the main door. It was Donald Spencer, a man who could not stand to see anyone in trouble without intervening, who was elected to try to convince Nash to accept the Michigan offer and enter the clinic voluntarily. Spencer chose, as he usually did, a bar as his venue. He invited Nash for some beers in Nassau Tavern, where Nash had once celebrated passing his generals. They sat in the booth for hours, Spencer downing warm martinis, Nash nursing a single beer. Spencer talked and talked. Nash seemed to be listening, but said very little except to remark at various intervals that he wasn't interested in doing statistical work. It was no use. Nash didn't believe that he was ill, and he wasn't prepared to enter another hospital. Years later, Winters wept when he recounted the story. "I thought I had worked out a perfect solution to a most unusual problem. I thought I could save a very worthwhile person. I'm very emotionally tied to this. I thought I was doing something really wonderful. Jim Miller told me never let Nash get shock treatments. It takes the edge of genius off. Somebody sent him to Carrier where they gave him shock treatments. I think it turned him into a zombie for many years. I considered that one of the worst failures of my life. When I look at the human race all over the world, I think there's zero reason for humanity to survive. We're destructive, uncaring, thoughtless, greedy, power-hungry. But when I look at a few individuals, there seems every reason for humanity to survive. He was worth doing the very best for." Meanwhile, Alicia, Virginia, and Martha had agreed among themselves that Nash would have to be committed involuntarily. This time, they chose a private clinic near Princeton. Martha wrote to Spencer, "The only reason it has not been done before now is that my mother and I are waiting to hear from Alicia when she has arrangements made. We really had thought we would do this in March. We were very hopeful that we could persuade John to go to the University of Michigan and take advantage of the opportunities for research and treatment there. Unfortunately, John will not agree that he needs treatment. Since we feel that something must be done for him, we have placed him in Carrier. He was simply not going to enter any hospital voluntarily. Once we were convinced of this, we had no choice but to commit him to a hospital in New Jersey." Chapter 42. The Blowing Up Problem. Princeton and Carrier Clinic, 1963-65. The Carrier Clinic, formerly a sanatorium for the senile and retarded, was one of only two private mental hospitals in New Jersey. Located in the picturesque hamlet of Belmead, amid rolling hills and lush farmland, Carrier was just 5 miles north of Princeton. Despite its easy proximity, however, it was generally avoided by Princetonians. As Robert Garber, a former president of the American Psychiatric Association who was Carrier's medical director at the time, recalled, "They didn't want to be in a psychiatric facility close to home. It was a disgrace, a terrible stigma, nothing like today. The idea was to get as far away as possible." Princetonians regarded Carrier, which had the look of a slightly seedy boarding school, with some distaste for another reason as well. Carrier had none of the prestige of top-of-the-line institutions like McLean, Austin Riggs, or Chestnut Lodge, whose academic affiliations, psychoanalytical orientation, and long-term approaches based on the talking cure were regarded especially by academics as more humane and appropriate, especially for the well-educated. Popular views of psychiatry were being shaped by One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, and the libertarian views of Thomas Saz, who held that insanity was a social construct rather than a symptom of disease. At the time when these views were gaining popularity, especially on campuses, Carrier had a reputation for the aggressive use of chemical straitjackets and electroshock, and short-term cookie-cutter approaches tailored to the time limits set by insurance policies. The Carrier staff, well aware of such attitudes, defended itself by arguing that its approach was more practical and worked better. McLean, Austin Riggs, Chestnut Lodge, Shepherd Pratt, and the Institute for Living, these were all much fancier, said William Otis, a psychiatrist on Carrier's staff. We were very clinical. None of us had any fancy training. None of us were stars. But the ironic thing is that if you were sick, you were much better off at Carrier. Garber said, At Carrier, we were proud of the fact that we set ourselves up as a short-term treatment center. That's why we were so successful. We were able to treat the patients and get them out, in contrast to McLean and Chestnut Lodge, which were notorious for having schizophrenic patients there for 4, 5, and 7 years. It was Alicia who, despite the impending divorce, felt responsible for Nash, and therefore had to face the decision. It took a great deal of courage, as anyone who has had to make such a decision knows. As one psychiatrist at Carrier said, commitments always created terrible conflicts in the family. It was very hard to find somebody who wanted to take the responsibility. Alicia, like everyone else around Nash, abhorred the idea of involuntary commitment and feared that treatment, besides being uncertain of success, carried the risks of irreparable harm. But she also knew that Nash was on a disastrous course and was convinced that failure to act would almost certainly lead to further deterioration. The psychoanalysts at McLean had failed. The effects of the shock treatments at Trenton had proved short-lived. She was prepared to try something new. She recognized that the most prestigious hospitals were unaffordable. At Carrier, patients' families paid a flat fee of $80 a day plus hourly fees for group and individual therapy. Virginia was able to pay that. Besides, it was important to Alicia that Nash be close by so that she and his old acquaintances at Princeton could visit him. So in the third week of April, after it had become all too clear that Nash was unprepared to enter treatment at Michigan, she went ahead with arrangements to have Nash taken to Carrier. Once again, she asked Martha and Virginia to come up to Princeton and sign the commitment papers. From the outset, however, Alicia drew the line at electroshock. We debated electroshock therapy, Martha recalled, but we didn't want to mess with his memory. At Carrier, electroshock was frequently used for schizophrenic patients who generally got 3 times as many treatments, 25 versus 8, as patients suffering from depression. Garber said, What we were trying to do was to gain control of that patient, to break through his excitement, panic, depression, in the shortest possible time. Generally, psychotic patients were initially treated with Thorazine, and those whose disturbed behavior didn't improve quickly were also treated with electroshock. Some of the psychiatrists at Carrier felt that the shock treatments were effective and produced fewer side effects than neuroleptic drugs. In any case, despite the nearly universal belief around Princeton that Nash received electroshock treatments at Carrier, he apparently did not. Nash spent most of the next 5 months of 1963 in Kindred One, the only locked ward at Carrier. He said later that he made efforts to overturn his commitment. If so, they were not successful. Frank L. Scott recalled that Nash went AWOL from Carrier at least once, presumably after he got ground privileges, and that he had to track him down and return him to the hospital. Compared to Trenton, however, Carrier was, if no country club, at least more like a reform school than a prison. There were just 80 patients, the majority of whom came from comfortable middle-class homes, many from New York and Philadelphia, and most of whom suffered from alcoholism, drug addiction, and depression, rather than from psychotic illnesses. Carrier had a dozen psychiatrists on its staff, a more adequate nursing staff than at Trenton, and a reasonable complement of medical doctors, psychologists, and social workers. Kindred One had single and double rooms. Nash, it seems, had a room to himself. He had access to a telephone. He was allowed to wear his own clothing. Patients were addressed by their titles and last names, so he was Dr. Nash, not Johnny, as he was at Trenton. Nash's wishes regarding his vegetarianism, which doesn't exclude animal products, for example, milk, but only the animal products which become available only at the death, execution of the animal, were apparently respected. Alicia visited regularly, as did a number of others from Princeton, among them Spencer, Tucker, and the Burrells. Probably the best thing that happened to Nash at Carrier was that he met a psychiatrist, Howard S. Mealy, who was to play an important and positive role in his life for the next 2 years. The psychiatrist, who happened to be on duty the night that Nash was brought to Carrier, was assigned to care for him. A short, soft-spoken, dapper man of Italian descent, who got his medical degree at Long Island College of Medicine and did his residency at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, Mealy was quiet and careful. Described by his former colleagues as conventional, cautious, not an exciting man, Mealy was, as later events showed, competent and caring. He was respected by the nursing staff. Belle Parmet, the Institute's social worker at the time, said of Mealy and the other staff psychiatrists, "They weren't just pill pushers or prescription writers, they were all humanistic." Nash responded quite quickly to his initial treatment with Thorazine. If someone responds at all to what are now called typical neuroleptics, dramatic changes are usually evident within a week, and the full effect becomes apparent within 6 weeks. 2 weeks after his commitment, Nash wrote a relatively lucid letter to Norbert Wiener, saying, among other things, "My problems seem to be essentially problems of communications. I don't know how they can be resolved. Perhaps I shall be able to approach their solution as a result of begging for aid. However, this isn't a begging letter." At this point, Nash was seeing Mealy for therapy sessions and also participating in group therapy, which Mealy particularly favored. There was, however, no thought of releasing him quickly. As Garber said, "Paranoid schizophrenics are not that responsive. Once you do get them under control, you have to satisfy yourself that they've stabilized. You don't want a relapse, especially if there's been a commitment, because then you and the family would have to start all over." By August, Nash was beginning to look forward to getting out of Carrier. He wrote to Virginia that he was anticipating Alicia's visit on the weekend and was thinking of getting out. He added that, "Mealy thinks it depends on having a job." Nash admitted that he was ill and in need of treatment, but said that Michigan might have been a better deal. He asked Milner for help in getting a job. On September 24th, Nash wrote again, saying that Sunday was a sad day because Alicia had to work overtime and couldn't come to take him out. He said that the Institute for Advanced Study had decided to offer him a position. A week later, upbeat again, he wrote that he was thinking of buying a car and that there were good prospects for a reconciliation with Alicia. It is a discouraging but well-documented fact that people who suffer from schizophrenia face an extremely high risk of suicide, comparable to those who suffer from severe depressions, and 100 times that of the general population. This risk is greatest not when the person is sickest, but shortly after a course of treatment has been declared a success. Though no one else can truly know the state of mind that leads someone to take his life, one can imagine that this is a time when the absence of delusions allows other feelings, including very painful ones, to emerge, and that hopes that one has been nurturing for months collide with harsh reality. Louisa Covin, who married Jean-Pierre Covin in the summer of 1963, has a haunting memory, which likely dates from that summer, the only time she ever talked with Nash. They met at a party. Presumably he was home from Carrier on a pass. Nash told Louisa that he didn't feel life was worth living, and saw no reason why he should not do away with himself. There is no evidence to show that Nash ever came close to acting on this thought, but he was certainly depressed. His hope for a reconciliation with Alicia, for example, proved overly optimistic. Alicia insisted that Nash live apart from her and Johnny, as John Charles was now called. So instead of moving back to Spruce Street, Nash found himself in a rented room at 142 Mercer Street, a few doors down from the house occupied by Einstein during his Princeton years. Once again, Burrell and Selberg had arranged a one-year membership at the Institute for Advanced Study, although this time they did so with less hope. The 1963-64 membership was probably a rescue mission. Burrell later said, "All members are voted by the whole school of people. I did the legwork. It was only to present the case to my colleagues." Oppenheimer decided this time to use the Institute's own funds, saying in a note to Selberg, "This enterprise seems to me not too suitable for contract funds," implying that in contrast to the previous 1961-62 appointment, this one was more clearly a charitable exercise. Meanwhile, Nash's old friends outside Princeton had not lost interest in his progress. A letter from David Gale to Dean Montgomery at the Institute, with copies to Milner and Morgenstern, gives a flavor of the level of interest in and concern about Nash's situation. "We got onto the subject of John Nash and wondered what his present situation was, in particular with regard to his state of mind. It turned out that none of us knew what was going on medically, nor did we know of anyone else who knew. We had all heard rumors varying from 'the doctors say there is no hope' to 'he's doing mathematics again.' The thing that disturbed us was not our own lack of knowledge about Nash's condition, but the thought that perhaps everyone in the mathematical community was in the same position we were, and that consequently Nash might not be getting the best possible medical attention. It is certainly true that the mathematical community has provided fellowships and jobs of various sorts for Nash whenever he has needed them. This is as much as we should be expected to do, provided some other competent, informed, and adequately endowed person or persons are looking after the medical situation. Since Nash is now at the Institute, I thought you might be in a position to know whether such a person exists, and to reassure us that everything that can be done is being taken care of. If it should turn out that for lack of money, for instance, Nash was not getting the care he ought to have, I'm confident that we could get together a Friends of Nash group to see what could be done about it." To come out, to go through the motions of starting over, to see one's old friends and colleagues again, was not easy. Nash stayed out of sight at the Institute. Few of that year's visitors recalled seeing him there. He complained in the fall of feeling lonely. He and Alicia still attended parties together, but she resisted any idea of their resuming their marriage. She was having difficulties at her job and found her son hard to handle. But when her mother took John Charles to El Salvador for several months that winter, she missed him terribly. Nash tried to be sympathetic, writing in March that, "Alicia is seeing a psychiatrist. She is very depressed. She was crying." Yet he also said that he was learning new things, and then in December that Selberg was trying to arrange visiting positions for him either at MIT or Berkeley. He continued to hope for a reconciliation. He and Alicia continued to socialize as a couple. Nash seemed, as the fall unfolded, to be in far better shape than he had been during his previous interlude at the Institute. As he said in his Madrid lecture, he had an idea which is referred to as Nash blowing up, which I discussed with an eminent mathematician named Hironaka. Hironaka eventually wrote the conjecture up. William Browder, who was also visiting at the Institute that year, recalled, "Nash was working on real algebraic varieties. Nobody else had been thinking about these problems." During the winter, Milner, by now chairman of the department, and his colleagues became greatly impressed by some extremely interesting ideas of Nash's in algebraic geometry. The new work sparked a wave of optimism and a renewed desire to help Nash. There was a growing feeling both at the Institute and at the university that Nash might well be able to resume his interrupted career. Milner decided to offer Nash a one-year post as research mathematician and lecturer. In April 1964, Milner tentatively proposed that Nash teach one course the following fall, and perhaps two in the spring. Milner consulted Nash's psychiatrist, Howard Mealy, who confirmed on March 30th that Nash was seeing him regularly for psychotherapy, noting that this was the first time that Nash had agreed to seek outpatient treatment since the onset of his illness. Garber recalled, "Mealy tried to keep him on medication. He also helped Nash initiate relationships with other people. In my experience, positive relationships plus medication does wonders. Someone likes me. That's an experience that's almost impossible for a schizophrenic to have." Mealy felt that Nash's recovery was permanent and that he could handle one or two courses without difficulty during the next academic year. He went on to say, "I cannot guarantee his future mental health, any more than I could my own or that of anyone else, but I do feel strongly that a recurrence is unlikely in his case." Dean of Faculty Douglas Brown wrote to President Goheen saying, "This is a special situation," adding that Nash is now recovered. He needs a chance to get back into teaching gradually and to reestablish his status. Brown said that the mathematics department unanimously supported the proposal. "I'm strongly inclined to go along. It is part of our job, I feel, in putting one of our most brilliant PhDs back into top productivity." The appointment was made officially on May 1st. Sadly, just when things looked brightest, and despite all of Nash's hard work, Mealy's support, and the outpouring of goodwill on the part of colleagues and the university, another storm was gathering. As early as February, Nash began complaining of sleeplessness and of his mind being filled with the thought of performing imaginary computations of a meaningless sort. A comment made in early March that he had avoided falling back into delusions suggests that Nash was already being besieged by such thoughts. And by the end of that month, Nash, who said he still hoped for a reconciliation with Alicia, mentioned that he felt he might have to leave Princeton. By the time the Princeton job was offered, Nash was already convinced that he ought to return to France, clear evidence that he was nowhere near as well as his behavior suggested. His letters home were sufficiently strange to alarm Martha, who contacted Mealy. Mealy was at first reassuring. He wrote back that Nash was no longer taking medication, but that Nash was still in therapy, and that the therapy seemed to be working well. Nash also wrote reassuringly, apparently in reply to questions from an anxious Virginia, that he was still seeing Mealy. But around that time, Nash paid an unexpected call on his former French professor, Carl Wheaty. He appeared rather anxious, Wheaty recalled. He said, "I'm interested in getting the addresses of Jean Cocteau and André Gide. I have to write them letters. I gently informed him that both Gide and Cocteau were dead, and that writing letters to them would be impossible. Nash was very, very disappointed." By May, Nash was complaining that he was having trouble working. "I have some ideas, but many of them don't seem to work out." Nash had apparently been in touch with Grothendieck once more. Grothendieck evidently responded with an invitation to the IHES for the following year. At the beginning of the summer, Nash wrote to a colleague in Europe, saying that he wished to spend the following year in France rather than stay in Princeton and accept the university's offer. Nash complained of finding himself in a troubled situation, saying that he had difficulty when he tried to work on mathematics, and also that his relations with various faculty and students at the university were troubled as well. It is not clear to whom or what he was referring. The job offer from the mathematics department had been supported unanimously by Milner and the rest of the faculty, and Nash's contacts with students were presumably limited to the fine hall common room. He wrote that he expected something to change by June 1st, but that he wasn't certain of that, adding, "Si ma situation reste essentiellement la même comme c'est de maintenant, if my situation remains essentially the same as it is now," drawing a circle in the middle of the page accompanied by the parenthetical remark, "ici compris ma situation de famille, etc., etc., including my family situation," he went on, "et si je peux travailler effectivement aux mathématiques par le temps de l'automne, je pense que je devrais accepter l'offre de Grothendieck plutôt que l'offre de l'université, s'il pourra encore me donner cette offre d'emploi." And if I can work effectively at mathematics by the fall, I think I should accept Grothendieck's offer over the offer from the university, if he will still extend me this offer of employment. As far as the Institute knew, Nash was planning to spend the entire summer at Fold Hall, with the exception of about 3 weeks, before going to France in the fall. On May 24th, in response to a note from Oppenheimer granting him funds for the summer, with the understanding that you will remain at the Institute during the summer, Nash wrote that he planned to be away from June 22nd through July 19th at a conference in Woods Hole on Cape Cod, organized by John Tate, on the theory of singularities, classifications of surfaces and modules, Grothendieck cohomology, zeta functions, and arithmetic of abelian varieties. According to Tate and other participants, Nash never went to the conference. Instead, he went to Europe. He sailed on the Queen Mary, stopped briefly in London, and went to Paris. There he tried to get in touch with Grothendieck, who evidently wasn't in town. After hanging around a few more days, Nash flew to Rome. He was, as he later said, thinking of himself as a great but secret religious figure. This may have accounted for his desire to be in Rome, where, as he later said, he visited the Forum and the Catacombs, but avoided the Vatican. The Pope was, in any case, not in Rome at the time. He was standing in front of the Forum when he began to hear voices, like telepathic phone calls from private individuals. They seemed to him at the time, he said in Madrid in 1996, to be the voices of mathematicians opposed to my ideas. He wrote in a letter later in the 1960s, "I observed the local Romans show a considerable interest in getting into telephone booths and talking on the telephone, and one of their favorite words was pronto. So it's like ping-pong, pinging back again the bell pinged to me." Something odd was happening, he concluded. Harold Kuhn later said, "The stream of words was obviously being fed into a central machine where they were being translated into English. The machine inserted the words, now in English, into his brain." Nash, however, did send a postcard from Rome, dated September 1st, saying that he was returning to Paris and that he had attempted to contact Grothendieck and other mathematicians. He said he would be staying at the Grand Hotel de Mont Blanc, where he and Alicia had stayed 5 years earlier. 2 days later, he was back in Paris, but had not yet managed to see Grothendieck, who was apparently away. The staff at the IHES suggested contacting Jean-Pierre Serre, but Serre does not remember Nash's ever getting in touch with him. Nash's next postcard home was a collage, a card devoid of any writing, with a Parisian scene and a French coin, and a long number for a return address. Meanwhile, Nash had not informed the mathematics department at Princeton that he was not intending to take their offer. Finally, on September 15th, Tucker sent a terse note to Dean Brown, canceling the appointment, and saying that Nash had gone to the University of Paris. Nash hung around Paris a few more weeks until he finally gave up. In mid-September, he wrote to Virginia from Paris that he would be returning on the Queen Mary on the 24th, adding a postscript, "Situation looks dismal." Back in Princeton, Nash took to calling people again and turning up at the Institute to write strange messages on the blackboards of various seminar rooms. Atlee Selberg recalled one such message involved several Social Security numbers. "He tried to find mysterious patterns," Selberg recalled. "He claimed that he was born in a county named Mercer that had a town named Princeton. He seemed to find this a mysterious sign." By mid-December, Nash was back in Carrier. Once again, it was Alicia who had to make the painful decision. A letter written to John Milner shows how fast Nash's thoughts were racing and how one association prompted another, even as Nash was conscious that Milner would find the letter mad. Labeled "Crazy Letter for Your Entertainment," it was a fantastic monologue, skipping from slave calendars and lunar eclipses to advertising jingles and equations from Milner's papers. Neely once again took over Nash's care, and Nash once again responded quickly and dramatically to antipsychotic drugs. He was well enough in early April 1965 to leave Carrier for the day to attend a banquet with John Danskin at another game theory conference in Princeton. As Danskin recalled, "Nash's name was being mentioned a lot at the meeting. I thought it would be nice to produce him." Once Nash learned that he would be going, he telephoned Harold Kuhn and asked him to bring a couple of game theory books to Carrier, which Kuhn did, recalling that it was a barracks-like place, not much privacy. Nash stayed on at Carrier until midsummer, his departure delayed until Mealy was confident that both a job and a psychiatrist were waiting for his patient. In April, Richard Palais, a mathematician at Brandeis, drove down to the Institute to turn in a manuscript. That day Burrell said, "Why not have lunch with Jack Milner and me?" "We had lunch," he recalled. Halfway through they started talking about Nash. Milner and Burrell thought Nash was much better now. They thought it would be a good thing for him to gradually get back to academic life. They believed Boston would be a good place. MIT and Harvard would be too difficult after he had insisted on resigning from MIT and threatened to sue the university. The Harvard department was too small. There was no way they were going to hire him. The Institute in those days didn't have 5-year memberships, and it was almost unheard of to have anyone more than 2 years. Norman Levinson, who had been in contact with Mealy, Milner, and Burrell, offered to support Nash with his ONR and NSF grants. He felt that it was too soon for Nash to have an office at MIT. Palais recalled, "I had a feeling they were on the level in helping him get back to the mainstream, and that it would be better for him to be in Cambridge, away from Princeton. It was very late. I'm surprised we were able to do anything. But the Brandeis administration really liked the math department, and Joe Cohn, then chairman, would go and get what we wanted." There was a lot of that feeling about Nash. People were expecting an awful lot from this guy. In any 4 or 5 year span, there are one or two young, bright people who are recognized as special. Everybody tries to get them. He was coming into that category. He was very special. When Nash got out of Carrier this time in mid-July, he spent a couple of nights at John Milner's house and then took a train to Boston. He was once again hopeful, and in contrast to a year earlier, accepted the likelihood that he might have to start a new life without Alicia. Chapter 43, Solitude, Boston, 1965-67. It was strange to be back in Boston alone, and after an absence of half a dozen years. The city had changed almost as much as Nash himself. Sundays were the bleakest. Nash's traditional Sundays, as he called them, were spent alone, sitting in one of the libraries trying to work, or more often walking for hours at a time and then stopping to watch the ice skaters and hockey players in the public garden. The evenings were given over more often than not to writing letters, one to Alicia, one to Virginia, and one to Martha, with whom Nash had lately developed a warmer, more confidential relationship. Mailing the letters provided an excuse for a final nighttime stroll. Weekdays, when he commuted to Waltham in a ratty old Nash Rambler convertible purchased on his arrival in Boston, were better. He was almost enjoying being at Brandeis. The place was undeniably lively, full of former students and acquaintances from the old days in Cambridge, former MIT undergraduates like Joseph Cohn, now chairman of the math department, and Al Vasquez, now an assistant professor. He liked having an office again, going to seminars, eating lunch with other mathematicians, tossing around ideas and mathematical gossip. But he was terribly lonely. He missed Alicia and John Charles. He felt his new, humbler status in the mathematical hierarchy most acutely. But he also could see, perhaps for the first time since the onset of his illness, that there was, after all, a future for him, and he entertained hopes of re-establishing himself as an academic and even of finding someone new to share life with. He had left Princeton almost immediately after being released from Carrier on July 29th, traveling to Boston by train and staying in a Cambridge hotel while he found an apartment and a car. He had seen Norman Levinson, who in his gruff, taciturn, immensely tactful way, had let Nash know that he would be paying Nash's salary with National Science Foundation and Navy grants, and that he hoped Nash would be able to pursue his own research ideas as before. He would have no teaching responsibilities, at least in the fall, which was a relief. He started to see a 33-year-old psychiatrist, Patterson Esmiol, an affable Coloradan with a medical degree from Harvard. Esmiol had just left the Navy to open a private practice in Brookline. Esmiel prescribed an antipsychotic drug, stelazine, similar to thorazine. Nash didn't like the drug and its side effects, worrying that they would prevent him from thinking clearly enough to resume mathematical work. But Esmiel, sympathetic to his client's concerns, kept the doses as low as possible, and Nash was grateful for the dependable human contact of his weekly appointments. Nash was seeing Eleanor and John David, now a tall, handsome boy of 12, every week or so. Nash was glad for the dinners Eleanor cooked him and glad to have the company. The three of them spent Halloween together, he wrote to Virginia. However, the old tensions in his relationship with Eleanor quickly surfaced again, and there were new and unanticipated tensions between himself and John David. Nash described Halloween as a sad occasion, for example, although it was not clear whether the sadness stemmed from friction that arose during the evening, or simply from a realization that his long separation from his son had produced a gulf that he could see no obvious way of bridging. John David was a particularly beautiful boy, musical and obviously bright. But Nash found it difficult to hide his dismay over his son's faulty grammar and indifferent performance in school. All John David had to do was to let a "you was" slip out, and Nash would be all over him. This, of course, led to flare-ups with Eleanor and a rekindling of all the old resentments. John Steer recalls his father's visits as frustrating. "He was always humming," Steer said. "He'd eat, he'd chill out, he'd leave. He never helped me with my homework or asked how I was doing. He was just very aloof." Before he became a teenager and he and Eleanor began living in Hyde Park, John Steer lived in 24 different places, with and without his mother. They included, between infancy and 6, a series of foster homes in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, an orphanage on the outskirts of Boston, and when finally reunited with Eleanor, the Chardon Home for Women and Children, a home for the destitute, no boys over age 9 allowed. In some school years, he attended 3 new schools and was deemed a behavior problem. On one occasion, he was held back. The moves were prompted by the calamities that are regular events in the lives of poor families: lost jobs, ill health, lack of child care, fear of crime. On one occasion, Eleanor recalled, "I had a woman taking care of him. She said John had been bad to her little boy, so she hit him and gave him black eye. I didn't work for a while. I was always on edge." It was, as he said, a miserable childhood, a shitty childhood. His mother loved him, of course, but was herself desperately unhappy. Eleanor was often ill, suffering at times from severe anemia, frequently lost jobs, and when she was working, often held 2 jobs. John David's illegitimacy was a dirty secret. Eleanor concocted a tale to explain away his fatherlessness, and the child was forced to tell it at the different schools and neighborhoods, while living in constant dread of discovery. "There was a real stigma," John Steer said. "I had to lie." In John David's eyes, however, his father's sudden reappearance in his life was a fine thing. Being corrected for the way he spoke and being admonished to work harder in school conveyed not just criticism but fatherly interest. Nash also promised to pay for John David's college education, explaining that his educational background will shape the whole future course of his life. Nash sometimes took pains to please his son. On Saturdays he would take John Steer and a friend bowling. Afterward they'd go to a Chinese restaurant for dinner. On John Steer's 13th birthday, Nash surprised him by taking him to a neighborhood bicycle shop and buying him a 10-speed racer. The next year, perhaps partly inspired by his father's interest in him, John Steer worked extremely hard in school, took a citywide examination, and got a place in one of Boston's elite exam schools. In January, Nash wrote that, "I have less time for Eleanor," hinting, perhaps, that he felt his early dependence on her company easing and feeling some relief on this account. This would have given Eleanor new grounds for grievance. She may well have felt that he was once again using her without much intention of giving her very much in return. But at the end of February, Eleanor and John David were among my few social contacts. There were repeated flare-ups. "Eleanor was not nice to me," he wrote after they went to a restaurant together. In April, when Eleanor moved to a new apartment, several days went by before she was willing to give him her new telephone number. In May, there is another reference to Eleanor's not being nice, which again made Nash feel rather sad. If Nash's reappearance in Boston raised again the possibility of his marrying Eleanor, either in her mind or his, there is no hint of this in Nash's letters to Martha. Nash still had not completely given up hope of a reconciliation with Alicia. On that sad Halloween, he'd been thinking a great deal of Alicia. "I was very fond of her," he wrote to Virginia. His sadness on that night probably had a good deal to do with the fact that she was discouraging him from visiting her in Princeton, as he had hoped to do on Thanksgiving. She apparently put him off with excuses, citing, among other things, propriety. Nash persisted, and Alicia continued to discourage him, so that a week before the holiday, Nash said that he still had no invitation. Alicia was now talking of his coming down at Christmas, but it is not clear that the visit took place. In and amongst it all, perhaps because he was now aware of John David's discomfort around him, he expressed fear that his younger son, John Charles, was forgetting his father. It was not all that easy to renew his old acquaintanceships, though he saw a bit of Arthur Maddock and his wife Joan, as well as Marvin and Gloria Minsky. People were kind, but busy. He was anxious for anything to fill his evenings and went to a great many movies, plays, and concerts by himself. Alicia, who continued gently to discourage any possibility of reconciliation, was encouraging him to find some female companionship. He wrote to Martha, "Alicia doesn't leave much hope." In January, Nash was making awkward inquiries about dating. He thought of inviting the Maddocks to his home for a meal and making it a foursome. Jean Maddock reintroduced him, apparently, to Emma Duchesne, who later could recall none of this. He pursued Emma for several weeks, saying to Martha, "She's a good conversationalist, but she isn't pretty, really," before discovering that Emma had a fiancé. After seeing A Hard Day's Night one Sunday afternoon in early November, he was seized by a terrible sense of regret that he poured into a poignant and introspective letter to Martha, full of references to the struggle between his merciless superego and old simple me. This is the letter in which Nash referred to the special friendships in his life and his realization in 1959 of how things had been. He admits that, "Away from contact with a few special sorts of individuals, I am lost. Lost completely in the wilderness." Brandeis was lively. A post-Sputnik infusion of money and a commitment on the university's part to building a serious graduate program in mathematics had attracted 8 or 9 young comers all in their 30s. "We had lots of research money. We had plenty of money to pay for research associates and part-time instructors. We did everything together," recalled Richard Palais. The atmosphere was friendly and informal, and Nash felt welcome there. "Everybody was well aware that he was a first-class mathematician," said Palais, adding, "I ate with him most lunches. It was nice to see him more or less back. He was pretty sane. He was being treated with antipsychotic drugs. He was a much nicer person after he got sick than before. I kind of knew him when I was an instructor at Harvard, but not personally. I'd ask him a question. He'd be all snotty, proud of himself. You'd be afraid to ask him anything. He'd put you down without a thought. Typically, I'd say, 'I have this problem,' and Nash would shoot back, 'Oh my God, how can you ask me this question? How stupid are you? How come you don't know this?' Afterward, he was nice, gentle, lots of fun to talk to. The old ego stuff was gone." Vasquez has similar memories. "When Nash first showed up at Brandeis, he was pretty zombie-like. At the beginning, he said nothing. That changed over the course of the year. He got more and more normal. He started interacting with people. We mostly talked about mathematics. He never talked about his personal life." Nash's renewed appetite for life was most evident in the energy with which he was able to work that year. During that fall at Brandeis, he wrote a long paper, "Analyticity of Solutions of Implicit Function Problems with Analytic Data," that pursued to their natural conclusion his ideas about partial differential equations. He circulated his draft for comments and submitted the paper to the Annals of Mathematics in early January. Armand Burrell, one of the editors, sent it to Jürgen Moser to referee. After a few telephone consultations between Burrell and Nash, Nash quickly revised the paper and got a final acceptance from the Annals on February 15th. Nash was thrilled, writing to Martha on Washington's birthday, that the Annals was the most prestigious American mathematical journal. His renewed productivity produced a rush of self-confidence. He went to see Oscar Zariski at Harvard to discuss some new ideas and possibly to inquire about a visiting position. He made friends with a young German mathematician, Egbert Brieskorn, who was visiting at MIT that year. He showed Brieskorn his just-completed paper and talked over ideas for future work. Brieskorn was doing some interesting work in singularities. Nash had interesting ideas, Brieskorn recalled. He was always making propositions about what one could do, but I always got the feeling that he either couldn't or wouldn't do them himself. A touch of Nash's old arrogance returned. There was some talk, apparently, of his teaching at Northeastern in the spring. I'd rather be at a more famous place, he confided to Martha. He thought he would apply for a position at MIT instead. He wrote Martha that he felt MIT ought to reinstate him, adding, Of course, MIT isn't the most distinguished. Harvard ranks much higher. Throughout the spring, he would fret about being forced to take a position at a second-rate institution. I hope to avoid stepping down in social status, because it may be difficult to come up again. As early as the beginning of February, Nash had an idea for a second paper, but 2 weeks later he wrote to Martha that he was sad because part of my new math idea fell apart. He was able, however, to take the disappointment in stride, and by early April he was already working on another paper on the canonical resolution of singularities. Many years later he would call this effort more interesting than his 1966 Annals paper. In May, he gave a seminar on the subject at Brandeis, and by the end of the month he had completed a draft that he showed to Brieskorn for comments. Nash quite likely submitted this paper to the Annals as well, but it was never published. A copy finally wound up in Feinhall Library at Princeton in September 1968. It was regularly cited in the succeeding years and was ultimately published in the Duke Journal of Mathematics in 1995 in a special issue in honor of Nash. The quality of these two papers, the first of which geometer Mikhail Gromov called amazing, constitutes the single strongest reason for questioning Nash's diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. Producing papers that broke new ground was a remarkable feat for someone who had by 1965 been psychotic for most of 6 years and suffered substantial memory impairment. Unlike manic depression, paranoid schizophrenia rarely allows sufferers to return even for a limited period to their pre-morbid level of achievement, or so it is believed. However, at least one other mathematician with chronic schizophrenia was able, during a brief remission, to produce excellent work. And Nash's papers, though superb, were not as ambitious as those that he had planned to write before he became ill. At the end of June, Nash moved into Joe Cohn's apartment at 38 Parker Street in a two-family house not far from Harvard Square. Cohn was off for a year's sabbatical in Ecuador. The sublet was arranged by Faggy Levinson, who recalled, Everybody wanted to help Nash. His was a mind too good to waste. Nash enrolled in Operation Match, a Cambridge computer dating service. He was going on blind dates, acutely aware that I'll need to learn how to behave properly and be polite, etc. He wrote that he was hopeful and optimistic. I think I'll develop some good friends, and I'll get remarried, if not to Alicia, and then I'll have a happy family life. He had an appointment at MIT lined up for the fall. Ted Martin had offered to let him teach a senior seminar in game theory. In May, Nash wrote to Kuhn saying that he wanted to collect appropriate materials and learn about the more recent developments in game theory, and asking Kuhn for suggestions. Something, however, was no longer quite right. Some of his colleagues at Brandeis recalled an abrupt change sometime in the late spring. Palais recalled, He sort of lost his balance completely. He went completely haywire. Vasquez remembers a more gradual unraveling. He went right past normal and became hyper. At some point he wouldn't stop talking, and he didn't make any sense. By the summer he wasn't able to interact anymore. It's hard to say what triggered his relapse. Possibly Nash had become overconfident and had stopped taking his medication. He evidently spent the summer in Cambridge, By September, his letters to Martha were distinctly delusional. In one, he referred to the Indian wheel of life. If a person is always correct and right, there is good reason to hope. Alarmed, Martha wrote to Esmiel, saying that her brother sounded optimistic but not well. She quoted him saying that, "I've put my delusions aside," but she was sure that the delusions were now back in full force. Esmiel wrote back in early October saying that he had seen Nash and that he was about the same as last time. He urged her to express her concern directly to her brother. A day later, Nash wrote to Martha reassuring her that his optimism was well-founded, but admitting there are always dangers to worry about. But in the next breath, he went on to say that he'd had an interesting letter from Alicia about a large gift of money. Martha later recalled that Nash, in his delusional periods, was always hinting that something great was about to happen. By November, the tone of his letters had become paranoid, as in one to Virginia. "I'm very disillusioned in the past, hoping also that my future relations with all the relatives, and especially you and Martha, will be much better." At Thanksgiving, he wrote, "I didn't have much to be thankful for this Thanksgiving." He planned to go to Roanoke for Christmas and to spend New Year's, Alicia's birthday, in Princeton. Vasquez, who had an apartment near Nash's, was running into Nash, wandering around Harvard Square the way he later wandered around Princeton. He was concerned with the politics of Mao Zedong, that sort of thing. In Harvard Square, he was talking about a committee that was communicating with foreign governments who manipulated the news in the New York Times in order to send messages to him. He had this idea that with this information he could find out how negotiations between various powers were going. Nash was still attending the Harvard Math Colloquium on Thursdays. "He was very peculiar," Vasquez recalled. "He believed that there were magic numbers, dangerous numbers. He was saving the world." Soon, Cohn was getting letters from his neighbors, the landlords of the house, complaining that Nash wasn't taking out the garbage and that his apartment was full of piles of newspapers. Feggy recalled feeling horribly embarrassed and responsible. "Joe wanted to give up the apartment. He tried to reach Norman. He couldn't, so he called me. So I called Nash every hour on the hour. I was worried. I got this crazy idea to call up this minister he had been seeing. The minister told me Nash was out of town." Just after the New Year, Nash left Boston for the West Coast. He traveled first to San Francisco, where he spent several days visiting his cousin Richard Nash. He called his cousin first, who in turn called Martha. "He blamed Martha for hospitalizing him," recalled Richard Nash. "It was very hard for her to take. He came to my office. He was good-looking, very muscular. He was soft-spoken, but his voice was much stronger than now. He was a lot of fun to talk to. He liked to talk a lot late into the night. Sometimes he spoke rationally, almost poetically. He was very concerned about not being able to contribute. I started out so well," he said. "I think of myself as a valuable person, but I'm not contributing." Other times he made no sense. He had these things he was concerned about. "He went to see a Catholic priest in San Francisco. I said, 'I thought you were an atheist.'" Richard Nash, a broker, would drive to work in San Francisco and take Nash with him. Once there, he'd get on the bus and go all around. Dick Nash expressed astonishment that Nash mastered complex schedules, went all over, but always managed to meet Dick at the appointed place for the return trip, at exactly the right time. After that, Dick Nash recalled, "John called me at odd hours. He had no awareness of time. I told him to stop calling me after bedtime, then I'd get calls with just breathing. I was rude. I wish I'd been nicer." After leaving San Francisco, Nash went next to Seattle, arriving there on February 3rd. He almost certainly went there to visit Amasa Forrester, the only person he knew in Seattle. He seems to have spent nearly a month with Forrester, because he did not arrive in Santa Monica, his next destination, until Easter, which fell in mid-March that year. There, apparently Shapley and other acquaintances from Rand refused to see him. Nash visited Jacob Bricker in Los Angeles as well. Bricker recalled that Nash was acting really wild. Nash apparently called Esmiel from time to time, although he disregarded Esmiel's pleas that he return to Boston and resume his treatment. Martha also called Esmiel a number of times that month. Esmiel's idea was to use the promise of a job at MIT as a lever to get Nash back into treatment. Martin was talking about letting Nash teach a section of linear algebra the following fall, Levinson, still hopeful, was planning on Nash's being at MIT. He solicited a letter of recommendation from Armand Burrell at the Institute. Burrell's letter, dated May 17th, was a strong endorsement.